So I'd like to thank Anna and thank all the team who've been working to prepare this conference. I'm very pleased to be here, and there's a handout. I'm not going to be reading most of the text. When we get to Epictetus, we'll slow down. I actually want to work through the text a little more carefully, but I'll be referring to things. Some of this material is more familiar than others. Anyhow, so starting with the first item on the handout, that text one, it's just one of the many places where we get a very standard piece of Stoic doctrine, which is that impulse, which is this translation I'm accepting of horme, is what is distinctive of animals, along with perception. So my focus is, what is sort of horme? Now, I think our understanding of the Stoic doctrine of horme has improved greatly over the last half century, with special credit due to Brad Inwood, his 1985 monograph, who forcefully brings home the point that there's nothing particularly impulsive about horme. That is, it doesn't have to be an instinct, a drive, or a powerful urge. It is not what in French would be a pulsion. I don't know how it gets translated in French. I'll ask you after later. So all actions are expressions of horme, from the impulsive to the sedate and the deliberate. So I think that is absolutely correct. But along with this salutary message, and actually quite separable from it, I want to argue, we typically find another view, which is that impulses are the psychological causes of action, that that's their role, sort of in Stoic theory. Perhaps their intentions or plans or acts of will, as Inwood renders it, his own particular version of this, impulse is the mind giving commands to itself. That's an interpretation of some particular thing that Plutarch attributes to Chrysippus, but we needn't focus on that specific version. I'm interested in this view in its more general form, which I've captured in the second text on the handout, which is also a quote from Inwood, which is that an impulse is that psychological event that determines or causes action. So it seems to me that this has become pretty much a modern orthodoxy, this interpretation. Just about everyone I read on this today defers to Inwood on this point. And what I'd like to do is question the evidence in favor of this consensus on what I'm calling the standard view, or sometimes the causal view. And I want to test it against a rival hypothesis, which I put in the footer of the handout. So any page you turn, if you want to try and remember what it is that I'm actually trying to argue for. At any rate, a hypothesis that I think that we should think clearly before we rule out, that my hypothesis is that horme is not a cause of action, but action itself. Horme is what we do, not simply the cause of our doing it. So regarding the Stoic dictum that impulse is characteristic of animals, it helps to think of it in the verbal form. Horman, the infinitive, is characteristic of animals. Now, one reason why impulse in English is an imperfect translation of the Stoic term of art is that, unlike horme, impulse doesn't have an intransitive cognitive verb. We cannot say, I impulse. Right? We can say, I impel, but that means, you know, something different. But horme does have a verbal form. We can horman towards the enemy or towards the goal line. And so my proposal, in effect, I guess one way to put it, is that the verbal form of impulse, when we're translating Stoics, should be something like pursue. And I'm not sure how Victor's translation effort fits in here. It seems we could go either way on this. So as animals, as I'm reading the Doctrine of Horme, we go after things. We engage in purposive behavior. And in this connection, a comment that Brad Inwood makes in the 1985 monograph has really resonated with me over the years. And sort of, I've been kind of like an intellectual itch to scratch. And I guess this paper is sort of scratching that itch. He notes that we find very little discussion of praxis, use that term, in our surviving Stoic texts and our testimonia. Rather, horme is the heading under which the topic is treated. So this, my hypothesis, would actually explain that. So the preponderance of our Stoic texts on horme concern a particular kind of horme, the irrational and excessive impulses that are defined as the pathe, and the four standard genera of the pathe, according to the Stoics. I've just listed them in text three, along with their properly corrected equivalents, the eopatheae. And text three also notes at least the evidence that the pathe are kinds of horme. Okay. Now, there is some tendency in the literature to suppose that it is here, in the doctrine of the pathe, that we will find the causes of action. So, epithumia and phobos, those two genera of pathe, are usually singled out for this job, sometimes only epithumia, and then with a proper appreciation of the relation to the eopatheae, due to, I think, Tad Brennan and Margaret Graver especially, I think they're absolutely correct on this, it's recognized that this won't do, because you can't get all the causes of action out of the pathe and the eopatheae, given what the eopatheae have to be. It's another story for another day. And so you need a non-pathetic impulse to action. And so ecloge, selection, is proposed as the impulse for the properly restrained pursuit and avoidance of preferred and dispreferred indifference. And in the abstract I submitted for this paper, I called this the holy grail of Stoic psychology, this role that's attributed to ecloge. So Stoics do invoke ecloge, and I think they do. It is the proper attitude to take to indifference, such as health and wealth and safety and so forth. But I don't. Our evidence does not show that it is an all-purpose impulse to action of the sort that it's supposed to do on this story. And this I'm agreeing with Stephen White. And for what it's worth, and here I'm going to direct your attention to text 4, which is from Stobaeus, which is a list of some of the rational impulses there are. Ecloge does not occur on this list, so maybe that doesn't show very much. But one thing I would note, if you look at the last item on the list, which is the definition or description of what paraskoue is, so preparation, I think, is how Pomeroy translates it. Preparation is a praxis before a praxis. So one data point that is congenial to my hypothesis. And now for full disclosure of my own view, not all of which I'm going to be arguing for today, although I'm going to try to argue for my hypothesis without contravening things that I reject in the other part of this project. In fact, this is what I think the pathe and the eopatheae also should be understood as: fully complete actions of the mind and not as the psychological cause or side of behavior. So I actually think the doctrine of the pathe is a really small corner of the Stoic doctrine of horme. It's not going to find anything there or in the neighborhood to be a general theory of the causes of action. But this is the full disclosure part. It's not what I'm arguing for today, although thinking through this set of issues is what brought me to the topic that I'm discussing today. So in any case, I'm largely going to set aside the sorts of considerations that can be invoked for or against my hypothesis by invoking the pathe, except for one text that I think I'm allowed to use in this context. We'll see whether you believe me. So I'm largely going to be looking at other texts and evidence for what the doctrine of pathe, horme is. Now, my suspicion is that it is not the weight of the actual evidence that leads to the current consensus, and what I'm calling the standard view, but rather, maybe from two things, a philosophical predisposition that reflects current philosophical paradigms. And perhaps there may be a vestige of the discredited view of horme as a strong feeling or urge. Because on that view, a strong feeling or urge is something you can introspect, you can distinguish from the behavior it may or may not give rise to, depending on whether you manage to hold down and resist it. And one way of thinking about the position that Inwood and the current consensus has is they tone down the phenomenal content of that mental state, strip off what Brennan uses this wonderful phrase, strip off the thrills and chills, but still retain the view that you have here a distinct item, a horme, that then goes on to produce an action. Now, you might suppose that we can appeal to the Stoic metaphysics of causation to provide a quick and decisive refutation of what I'm calling the standard view. You might say, well, impulses cannot be causes of action for the Stoics, because causes, in their view, are bodies, while impulses are not. Here, so given you in text 5, from the standard text, that impulses are motions. An impulse is a fora of the soul. So it's not, they're not bodies. So that's the quick and dirty refutation of the view. But I think it doesn't do justice to the view that I'm resisting, because the Stoic ontology of causation is a very different one from the one most of us employ today. And it's, I don't think it's the one that Inwood and others are appealing to when they invoke, when propose that horme is a cause of action. So my view is that even if we are using cause in the non-Stoic sense, where an event or a movement can be a cause, Stoic horme still doesn't turn out to be a cause of action, as opposed distinct from the action itself. Now, this is not to say, I'm still in the long list of things that I'm not doing. Okay. This is not to say that I'm disputing the physics or the mechanics of action that's attributed to Cleanthes by Seneca in our text 6, which is the view that movements in the psychic pneuma stretch out to the feet and presumably move them, if they were walking, in roughly the way that Aristotle makes fun of in Book 1 of the De Anima, when he likens Democritus's view of the soul to quicksilver poured into the statues of Daedalus. So that's the kind of the mechanics of action that I'm not contesting. So Cleanthes' picture of the mechanics of walking fits, I think, a very well-attested Stoic picture of the soul performing its various functions by extending, by ektene, or diatene, from the commanding faculty, sort of here in the midriff, out to the relevant bodily organs. You could take the same thing for sight and for speaking, and so here we have it going down to the feet for walking. So what I have to say is, I think, consistent with this picture. So the question I'm addressing concerns not the physics or the mechanics of action, but rather, is it a question, what is action? And my proposal is that the Stoic answer to what is action, the answer is horme. So, and also, I'm also not disputing, and here I get to hand out text 8, which is just a list of items. I'm not disputing what Inwood calls the standard causal sequence in the psychology of action, that first there's impression, fantasia, then there's assent, sunt catathesis, then impulse, horme, and then action. That's also well attested. My issue concerns the relation between the last two items in the sequence, that is impulse and action. While Inwood claims that the first three on this list precede and generate the action to be explained, my proposal is the causal role is performed by the first two. Now, then, to bring you to text 9, a very short snippet here from Cicero's De Fato, where Chrysippus is making this final conclusion in his response to an incompatibilist argument that invokes this standard causal sequence. It's mixed up in order in ways that, in the way the objection is raised that I don't think we need to go into here. I would just note, that's what this text is for, that Chrysippus, after giving his own diagnosis of what's wrong with the opponent's argument, he concludes in text 9, it does not, he says, it, you can concede this and concede this and concede this, but it does not follow that impulse, too, is not in our power. He doesn't say it doesn't follow that action is not in our power. He says impulse. It doesn't follow that impulse is not in our power. But if impulse is what we do, then whether impulse, whether horme is in our power is precisely the point at issue. Okay. So much for what I'm not saying, and along the way, a few data points that actually fit perfectly well with the hypothesis. Now, what I am saying. So what I am saying is that once we distinguish between what I'm calling the standard view, that impulse is a cause of action. And my hypothesis, which is that impulse is action. And then we look at our Stoic texts and testimonia on Horme. We don't find evidence to prefer the standard view over the hypothesis. And I think we actually find some that counts more towards the hypothesis. And I think that the motivation for the standard view primarily comes from taking the only alternative to be that discredited view of Horme as a drive or an instinct. But there are sort of two alternatives, and I think we need to be careful about which we go for. So now I want to look at, or at least draw your attention to, some of the textual evidence. So I start with the account of Stoic ethics in Diogenes Laertius in text 10, which starts by saying that impulse, horme, is first, lists it first in the topics included in the ethical part of philosophy by the Stoics. So that's in section 84. And immediately afterwards, in 85, Diogenes goes on to elaborate that first topic, at least that's how I read it, by giving the doctrine of oikeiosis. Okay, so the animal's first impulse, horme, is to preserve itself, and so forth. I think this is a description of animal behavior. This is a case of describing horman, the affinitive. So there's no need to suppose that what is invoked here in the doctrine of oikeiosis is simply the psychological cause of that behavior, like it's the animal's first desire or inclination. Rather, going after things, like their own bodily integrity and safety, is something animals do, according to the doctrine of oikeiosis. So, of course, this doesn't rule out the standard interpretation of horme, but it certainly doesn't require it. Now, I want to consider where impulse is introduced into the summary of Stoic ethics that we find in Stobaeus. And some of this is in text 12. And my sense is that this is pretty much the same story, at least the way Horme is presented, is pretty much the same, gives you pretty much the same story that we have in Diogenes Laertius. Here, impulse, Horme, is mentioned in the context of the doctrine of indifference. Not everything that is indifferent in the normative sense, that is neither good nor bad, is something that we are indifferent towards. Rather, various natural objects of pursuit, like life, health, freedom from pain, they stimulate in us an impulse to pursue them. That's the basic doctrine that we're given here. So they are, to quote my slight modification of Pomeroy's translation, says they are stimulative of an impulse towards themselves or towards our possessing them. Now, we could take this to mean that these objectives, like health and safety, stimulate in us a psychological state, like a desire to flee, that then in turn brings forth our behavior of pursuit, or in this case, avoidance. But it could simply mean, and I think this is the natural default reading, that we are stimulated to horman epi, these objectives, to go for them. So construed, an impulse towards safety would consist in running to higher ground as floodwaters rise. In such a case, horme would be the behavior, not just its psychological cause. So I think my hypothesis does very well with these texts. So the what we get in Diogenes Laertius and what we get here in chapter 7 of the account in Stobaeus. So I'm going to be calling this the chapter 7 account of impulse. So moving on to another part of the summary in Stobaeus, where horme comes up again, the topic of impulse is introduced in its own right in chapter 9. Now, text 13 has the opening lines of chapter 9, or section 9. I've never understood all the numbers in Stobaeus. And I'm particularly interested in what in the translation is the second sentence here. So here we get the generic definition of horme in its genus as, quote, a motion of the mind towards something, so epitip. And I'm interested in how are we supposed to understand the epitip? So given that the passage goes on to say, this is not in the handout, that impulse has different species, rational and non-rational, and then it opposes horme to aphorme. So you have aphorme from predators and the like. I think there's some reason that we can take the epite to again to refer to the orientation to pursue the preferred indifference or to flee from the disparate preferred indifference. That is what we have in the Chapter 7 account. But there in the Chapter 7 account, I argue, there's no reason to take horme to be a psychological cause of action, a desire to flee, rather than the activity of flight. Okay, but there's another way of reading epite in our text. I think it was it text 13? I've got my numbering slightly off. And that's suggested when you get into section 9b, which is text 14. This is actually a text that Victor talked a little bit about this morning. So here the role of assent, of synkatathesis in impulse, is described more precisely than what we had at the beginning of text 13. So the background doctrine here is that impulse arises from assent to an impression. And the first line of text 13 tells us that the impression, the fantasia, is an impression that such and such is kathekon, or appropriate. So here, back in text 14 and 9b, we are told that the assent, strictly speaking, is directed to a proposition, to an axioma in the data, while the impulse is directed epi a categorema. So epi, the accusative here, epi, so I'm just calling this, translating a predicate. So putting all this together, we get the doctrine, if one has an impulse to walk, then the proposition assented to is walking is kathekon, walking is appropriate. And then walking, peripatein, is the predicate that the impulse is epi. So it's a slightly different, interpretation of what epite means here. This is the chapter 9 account. So in this case, what the impulse is epi is not one's target or objective, like health or safety, one's target or objective in acting, as on the chapter 7 account. Rather, the impulse is epi action itself, right? So an impulse that is epi-health in the Chapter 7 sense could be an impulse epi-walking in the predicate sense, if you're walking to stay healthy. So these seem to me to be two different but perfectly compatible ways of describing the same impulse. They answer two very different questions you could ask about an impulse. What is the action that it is an impulse to do, and what is the goal of so acting? Okay. So now suppose that in what we have in text 15 or text 14 is an impulse to walk. So the predicate is to suppose that the predicate is walking. Now Inwood takes this formula here in citing this text to mean that the impulse, construed as an interior psychological event or state, is the cause of walking. He just sort of gives a causal reading of this. But our text falls short of saying this. And I wrote here, so note the absence of any causal language. Well, actually, there is some causal language in text 14, but what is kinetikon of impulse, right? So there's no causal language of talking about impulse causes. So what we have here in saying that horme is epi a categorema, or epi a predicate, I think what we have here is what I would classify as a teleological specification of impulse, what the impulse is for. Now, as a good Aristotelian, it seems to me that there are two ways in which walking can be the telos of an impulse. And these correspond to the two kinds of telos that Aristotle distinguishes at the in the opening lines of the Nicomachean Ethics. That is, some goals, some tele, are products, while others are our activities. So as I read it, the standard view of impulse takes walking to be the telos of impulse in the sense of being its product, in the way shoes are the telos of the cobbler. So on my alternative hypothesis, walking is the telos of the impulse in the way an activity like dancing can be a telos. So dancing is what you are doing on a particular occasion. Dancing is the point of all the various micro components, micro actions or sub actions. Maybe you're performing your visual and other perceptual activities, their bodily movements, all that stuff's going on when you're dancing. What is it? What are you doing? I'm dancing, right? So this way of pointing to the telos points to the thing that in many cases, especially when you have very complicated and complex activities, is the thing you have the easiest epistemic access to. In comparison to being able to describe, let alone even intend, all the components and constituents of the process. So, and it's also what often answers the question with the what are you doing question. I'm doing Tai Chi, or I'm orienteering. Like you give the point to something. Okay, so on this way of reading, walking is the telos of impulse. To say that the impulse is epi-walking is actually to identify the impulse. It is to say what the creature in question, what the animal is doing. So an impulse to walk, I take it, is walking on this construal. So that's the, that's the alternative to the taking that the impulse to walk takes walking to be the product, so the causal product of Corme. Now, here's where I'm actually going to appeal to the texts on Pathé. So we actually have some direct evidence that the predicate that goes after the epi serves to identify the impulse rather than indicate a distinct activity that the impulse causes. So this is where I go to the doctrine of the Pathé, but not, I think, anything that I'm not entitled to use given what else I think about the Pathé. So this is text 15, which defines, or I take these are definitions of the Pathé that are in the genus Hedone and Lupe, which I'm calling delight and distress, respectively. So here we have the definition. There's a long supplement to the text here, but I've given parallels that I think this is Bucksmith's supplement, but I think it's got to be correct. So here we are told that delight is an expansion or elevation of the soul. It's an eparsis at the thought that something good is present. It involves the thought that it is appropriate to epeirous thought. Similarly, distress is a contraction of the soul, a systole, due to the thought that it is kathekon to systelis thai. So, put this together with what we have in text 3, standard doctrine that the pathé are kinds of impulse. And so what we have here shows us that delight, which is an elevation of the soul, is an impulse to elevate. So, and similarly, distress, which is a contraction of the soul, is an impulse to contract. So in these cases, at any rate, distress and delight, an impulse is defined in terms of the, it is defined in terms of the predicate that it is epi. It's not, we don't get some further thing that the impulse causes that is specified by the predicate. So the impulse is not the cause of the activity specified in the predicate, but I take it the activity identifies the activity itself. So I take this to actually be evidence against the standard view. Now, Inwood, and actually probably more explicitly on this point, Brennan, I think, would take my modus ponens here as a modus tollens, because when discussing these texts, the ones on distress and delight, so their view is that these are not impulses in the fullest sense, since they don't have discernible actions to which they are directed. But this is to presuppose the standard view, and my project here is actually to look for some evidence that actually requires us to prefer the standard view to the alternative hypothesis. So I think that we have to agree that at least in these cases, so distress and delight, the relation of the impulse to the activity that it is epi in the chapter 9 sense is not the causal one invoked on the standard view. So my hypothesis then is the same goes for the impulse that is epi-walking in our hypothetical case and quite generally for impulse as a whole. So what the standard view really needs is some good independent evidence that the Stoics made some, I don't know if I've got this right, what we call an ontological distinction between the horme and the action, that it is epi. So now look at text 16, which is a famous passage from Galen, in which Chrysippus distinguishes between the impulse to walk and the motion of the legs, and also the impulse to run and the motion of the legs. In the case of walking, he says, the impulse is not exceeded by the motion of the legs, while in the case of running, the motion of the legs does exceed the impulse. But this doesn't give the standard interpretation what it means unless walking, or running, to change the example, is identified with the motion of the legs. That's not what Chrysippus says here in this passage. And if we go back to Seneca's report in text 6 of the dispute that Chrysippus has with Cleanthes, we see that neither Cleanthes nor Chrysippus would identify walking with the bodily movement, with the movement of the legs. Rather, they identify it with the psychic movement. So walking is not the same as the motion of the legs, but rather at least for as far as Chrysippus is concerned, walking is the Cleanthes says walking is the psychic motion, and Chrysippus goes even further and says walking is the hegemonicon, it's the commanding faculty. Now, this is decidedly strange, alien-sounding doctrine. Inwood describes it, particularly Chrysippus' version, as an overstatement of what he takes to be the core Stoic doctrine, which is that impulse causes actions, not that they're identical with the actions. He takes it to be an overstatement that's motivated by some concerns about responsibility. As he puts it, the reason why Chrysippus would identify walking with the hegemonicon, he says, impulse refers to what an agent does in an important sense by isolating the act of setting oneself to do something in contrast to the physical accomplishment of the corresponding bodily movements. And that's all well and good as far as I'm concerned. But we're still looking for some evidence that the impulse is simply the setting oneself to do something and doesn't extend to include the corresponding bodily movements, the doing itself. So it would help the standard view if there were texts that show impulses can, or that can, they can sometimes fail to issue in the actions that they are directed towards. Cases where one has the impulse to act, but action doesn't ensue, or doesn't ensue immediately. Now, Richard Saramji has argued, citing cases of the pathe, like anger, has argued for this, that the impulses need not issue an action, citing cases like the desire for revenge, anger, that can predate the vengeful action and sometimes peter out without ever being acted upon. But I want to set aside cases of the pathe as disputed, or anyway, I'm disputing them, because for what it's worth, I think that the anger, the desire for revenge, and the action of revenge, I think those are actually distinct impulses. What would help and what would be relevant here is evidence about whether the Stoics think you can have an imp, a horme, but it not issue in the action that it is a horme epi. Now, Inwood cites Epictetus as evidence that our hormi are sometimes impeded from issuing in bodily actions. He thinks that the Stoics are committed to this, he says, and here I quote, can be inferred with some confidence from Epictetus's constant assertion that human impulses are unhinderable while our bodily actions are not. Now, this is a widely held interpretation of Epictetus' doctrine of what is up to us, or the epheme. But I think a careful consideration of the relevant texts in Epictetus doesn't support it. On the reading that Inwood needs, Epictetus' doctrine has sort of two crucial claims. One is that we can't be prevented from having impulses to act. But the second one, our impulses to act can be prevented from issuing into bodily movements, which is bodily actions. Now, if you look at text 17, which is the opening lines of the handbook, it does look like we get both of these theses that Inwood needs. We are given a general distinction between things that are up to us and correspondingly unimpedable, and then those that are not up to us and that are impedable. And here I'm actually going to read the translation. So Epictetus says, some things are up to us, others are not. Up to us are supposition, impulse, desire, aversion, and in a word, whatever is our own doing or our haematera. Not up to us are the body, possessions, reputation, offices, and in a word, whatever is not our own doing. And those that are up to us are by nature free, unimpeded, unhindered, while what is not up to us are weak, enslaved, impeded, and not our own. Here, impulse is on the list of things that are unimpedable. Now, Inwood takes this to mean that we can't be impeded from having impulses. But what counts as impediment here, unimpeded and unhindered, a koluta and a apodista here, is not yet interpreted in the context. And we really require an interpretation of what these terms mean, because if you just look at even the lines that I just read, in what sense are the body, possessions, and reputation impedable? We have the hypothesis that the body being impeded is you keeping the body from doing it, but how do you impede reputation and possessions? So there's no precise sense to be made of that claim, so I think some kind of shorthand is being used here. And we do get a more precise statement of what Epictetus means in the following lines. So he says, if you take what is naturally enslaved to be free, and what is not your own to belong to you, you will be hindered, aggrieved, and disturbed. So more precisely stated, it is the person who will be impeded, or not impeded, the person who will be prevented, and so on. Now, Epictetus goes on to give an example of what would count as being impeded. It's not on the handout, but it's very familiar. You go to the public baths with a strong aversion to being splashed, and you get splashed all the same. That is being impeded. Being unimpedable would be going to the baths without that aversion. In both cases, though, we have a successfully completed bodily action, going to the baths. Action has gotten out of the box or out of the starting blocks or whatever the right metaphor is here. It's a subsidiary goal or a side constraint of the action, not being splashed, that has been frustrated or impeded. There's more on this theme in Chapter 9 of the handbook, and I'm just sampling here, and we have some of this in Text 18. You can be impeded insecure. We can be impeded in our pursuit of honors, public office, property. But impediment, or what counts as impediment in these cases, is not a matter of setting oneself to do something, but then having that resolution fail to generate the corresponding bodily movements. Rather, in these cases, think of being impeded in your pursuit of public office, there's been a successful transition from psychological cause to bodily movement. No doubt many such completed actions, for example, canvassing in support, trying to get support from others for your bid for public office. So the impediment consists in the failure of these actions, these fully complete, fully executed impulses, to achieve their objective, in the Chapter 7 sense. So Epictetus here is not saying that an intention or a choice can be impeded in issuing from bodily action. And the discourses are no different on this point. Very opening of Discourses 1-1 makes precise the claim that opens the handbook in the way which I believe in the handbook is more precise than the way I went through it. It says now, what is up to us, in fact, the only thing that is up to us, he says, is not He says, he doesn't say horme, he doesn't say ekklesis or any of the things said before, but the only thing up to us is the correct use of impressions. Emphasis here is on the correct use. Now, I take it that to use impressions here is to assent or to withhold assent from an impression, and to do so correctly is to assent only to the true impressions. So note that we do not have here from Epictetus a general thesis about assent being up to us, for the thesis only concerns correct assents. There's something here, what's up to us now in the domain of only belongs to those who assent correctly. Now Epictetus proceeds to claim that, again, I think I didn't put this on the handout, but he continues in the text, to claim that one is open to hindrance if one fails to use impressions correctly. So again, impediment, hindrance connected to not being up to us. And so if you don't use impressions correctly, and as a result you form attachments to externals, like, you know, beauty, wealth, and so forth. Now, look at the example he gives, and this is in section 16, still of this same text, the example of an impediment. It's sailing, or as a word, not sailing. Right? As in the handbook examples, it's not a case of, here, let me actually read that section since I said I would at least pay some attention to Epictetus' text here. Here we are. Okay. So starting at the end of in 15, in the middle of this is text 19. And being tied to many things, because we've assented to false normative propositions, we are weighed down and dragged along with them. And so, if the weather forbids us to sail, we sit down and fidget and keep peering about. When will the west wind blow? When it wants to, or when it pleases Aeolus. For God has not made you steward of the winds, but Aeolus. So as in the handbook examples, it's not this. We don't have here a case of a resolution to act that fails to issue in bodily movement. Rather, what we have here is a plan to sail that's thwarted by the lack of a favorable wind. We can imagine the frustrated traveler sitting on deck, having stowed away his goods and successfully completed all kinds of bodily actions, right? No paralysis or anything like that, sitting there on deck, fretting about when the wind will blow. It's the wind that's not up to him, Epictetus tells him. As far as his control of his bodily movements go, as far as the traveler's control of his bodily movements, Epictetus has nothing to say. Now, this passage continues, and that's in text 20, and here we get the famous phrase, my leg you will fetter, but not even Zeus will fetter my prohairesis. Now, this can be, and I think is, interpreted out of context to say that you can't keep me from deciding correctly, but you can keep me from executing my prohairesis using my body. I think that's how it's usually read. But the examples in the context don't bear out this way of reading it. So here I'm going to read from the text. This is in text 20. It's just so inspiring to read out Epictetus. It's not like reading most philosophy. I must die, but must I die groaning? I must be fettered and crying too? I must be exiled, but does anyone keep me from going with a smile, cheerful and serene? Reveal your secrets. I refuse, for this is in my power. But I will fetter you. What do you mean, man, Anthrope? Right? My leg you will fetter, but not even Zeus will fetter my prohairesis. So what the message here is that you can't make me groan rather than smile when I'm about to be beheaded. You can't make me frown rather than smile when I'm in fetters, and you can't make me divulge a secret by threatening to imprison me. So the examples we have here of unimpeded motion would be smiling rather than groaning and refraining from telling the secret, a complication because it's an inaction, but I think the point holds. Correspondingly, to be impeded or to be constrained would be to groan, to frown, to tell the secret. All of these, both the impediments and the unimpediment cases, are cases of fully successful bodily implementation of whatever psychological cause of action there is. These are not cases of paralysis or aphasia. So I think I've gone through, I think, a pretty fair sample of Epictetus to argue that Epictetus doesn't say the thing that Inwood says he does, and that would be a crude, and if, and that was, that there'd be some evidence that Stoics or a-Stoic or some Stoics take impulse to be a cause of action that sometimes can't yield issue an action. That I haven't found any evidence. Okay, so now, I mean, there are other texts. I'm happy to talk about your favorite ones in the question period. But now I want to conclude by saying, well, what's at stake in this argument I'm pursuing? So what have I shown if I have established the hypothesis? You might think this is basically, you know, a very small or verbal disagreement I have with Inwood. Because Inwood is, after all, not using Stoic vocabulary to express his interpretation. Okay, so in non-Stoic terminology, you might say, horme still is an internal psychological event that brings about the bodily movements that we are inclined to call walking or actions, even though Chrysippus, at any rate, will call the internal thing the action. We are inclined to call the external thing the action or the walking. So we can still say this because the pneumatic motion extending from the heart moves the limbs. So we can use sort of say, well, look, we're still agreeing about this. What goes on inside makes the body move in the way that we call actions. Isn't that all Inwood is claiming? So the Stoics have the perversity to identify the action walking with that pneumatic motion, or even worse, with its source, the hegemonicon. But even if the Stoics won't say so in as many words, that impulse causes walking, an impulse stands to walking as cause to effect, isn't that what their view amounts to if we translate it into a more familiar idiom? So I think that's a reasonable question to ask me. And I think that if all of that, what I've just said, is that's all, I take that's all that Inwood needs, and that's all we need in order to reject what I'm calling the discredited view of impulse, that it's a drive or an instinct or a strong, powerful urge. But that's not all that people do with what I've been calling the standard view. Because I think, and it's not all that Inwood and others do with the standard view. Because what I take to be the real issue here is a disagreement about the sort of job that the doctrine of horme is doing for the Stoics. So the standard view, what I've been calling standard view, and here's a sort of concomitant of it, that distinguishes horme from the action as the action's cause, allows for a question that the Stoics, I think, are not interested in answering, or at least Stoics other than perhaps Posidonius. That it's a question to which they do not think there is an interesting answer. Let me explain. So if we think that actions are caused by impulses, then for any given action, we can ask what sort of impulse caused it. Was it a normatively defective impulse, like a pathos, or a restrained impulse, then here's where we get people can't find one, so we think, well, maybe ekloge is this impulse. But the problem is this is sort of like the missing link in a certain theory of a Stoic psychology of action. We need ekloge has to play this role, but we can't actually find it doing that. Moreover, we find in our Stoic sources no general classification of the different kinds of impulse that issue in action, even in the long and detailed treatment of impulse that we get in Stobaeus. Now, it could be that the Stoics had such a classification, and our fragmentary and incomplete sources fail to report it, but I'm coming to the view that this would be rather like having the tripartite soul falling out of the doxography on Plato. I mean, this is not a small thing, especially given the heat that Posidonius and Galen following put on Chrysippus on precisely this issue. So in any case, the hypothesis that I've been putting forward can explain the absence of such a classification of impulses in our sources, and that there's no, that's not what impulse is supposed to do. So if the impulse to walk is the walking, then there's no further question to be answered about what kind of impulse brought about the walking, not if you're a Stoic. That is, was it epithumia? Was it boulesis? Was it ekloge? As if we were working with a Platonic or a peripatetic menu of parts of the soul and their characteristic desires that they issue in. But the Stoics, we know, or at least the Orthodox Stoics, the early Stoics, have a simple and all-purpose answer to the question, what kind of impulse caused the walking? The answer is that walking issues from the hegemonikon, from the commanding faculty. And as I would put it, sometimes the hegemonikon walks, sometimes it runs, and so forth. But whenever it does these things, it has decided to do them. It's assented to them as the appropriate thing to do. So that's all that there is to be said about what kind of impulse causes an action, at least in a rational agent. So perhaps it is what I might call Poseidonian sympathies that incline us to search for a classification of impulses that is distinct from the classification of the sorts of things that we do. So I think this would be a good place to stop. There's one last text I have that I think is an answer to a question that I'm likely to get. But what I think about that text is in the header to the text. So I think that's a good place to stop.